From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome to our Thanksgiving weekend edition. I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review Queen and Slim, starring Daniel Kaluuya and Jodie Turner-Smith. The Two Popes stars Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Pryce as Popes Benedict and Francis, two men with very different social views. And we'll hear about a new version of Les Miserables. This one isn't a musical, but it is French. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Coming your way for this Thanksgiving holiday weekend, we'll get started right after NPR News. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us for this Thanksgiving weekend. We have a lot of movies out for you to enjoy over the course of these several days. I'm joined by critics Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com, and Amy Nicholson, film critic for Unspooled, the podcast miniseries Zoom, and she also writes on film for The Guardian. Our first film this week is one that stars Daniel Kaluuya and Jodie Turner-Smith, Queen and Slim, about a black couple's first date, which takes an unexpected turn when a white police officer pulls them over.
Failed to execute a turn signal back there.
I'm going to ask you to step out of the vehicle for me.
Could you please hurry up? It's just cold.
Get on the ground! Keep your hands where I can see
him! Why is he under arrest? What is your badge number?
Chill! Just chill!
I'm reaching for my cell phone!
Queen and Slim is directed by Melina Matsoukas. It's her feature directing debut, and the screenwriter is Lena Waithe. Tim, you want to start us on Queen and Slim?
Very entertaining, this movie, in a number of ways. Thrilling, it's kind of funny, it becomes a bit of a road trip. Love these two characters together. But I'm going to poke it for a second, even though I like it. There's basically two movies going on here. One of them is this relationship movie. We see them on this date, they end up on this road trip after this thing happens, and we see this relationship build. They go to a lot of interesting places and meet interesting people and I love that movie. But the movie about them being on the run because of this thing that happens, the sort of Bonnie and Clyde-esque, Thelma and Louise-esque movie, the movie that's about social commentary, about things that are going on, that movie I didn't like so much. And it has to do with what happens in that clip that we just heard, the reason why they're on the run. Because, as we've seen in the trailer, he shoots that cop. The thing of it is, he was right to shoot that cop. But they take it on the heel and toe anyway. It's a whole thing that goes down. It eventually ends up on, is it body cam or the police vehicle cam?
I think it's the vehicle cam.
The vehicle cam. So it's all seen. Everybody can see all of what happened. To my mind, I project myself. You know, I'm him now. What do I do? She says, we got to run. I'm like, you're insane.
Yeah, we've got documentation of what happened.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll take my, first thing I'm going to do is call my mom. But I'm definitely not going to take
so
it on the
So the fact they weren't too sharp about what they did afterwards got in. That bothers me so much in movies.
That me through the rest of the movie.
When the protagonists don't do the smart thing, that always frustrates
me. It makes sense. You watch Thelma and Louise. They take it on the heel and toe, too. They should. They have to. She killed him. That was murder. Bonnie and Clyde, they were robbing banks. And,
not much gray area.
But here, no. The one thing that they shouldn't have done is run.
What do you think, Amy?
I love this movie. And I will say, there's kind of no they when they make that decision, though. They're this couple that's on a first date. They're very different. It's not going well. You know, she's a death row defender.
So she's an attorney.
She's an attorney.
And still tells him to go on the run.
She's the
one who worst advice from an attorney ever.
He actually
ever.
Is more like Tim. He's like, I want to call my dad. I don't want to do this. But it's a very impulsive act. And then they do something else impulsive very soon after. And then it continues from there. You know, this is Melina Matsoukas' first film, and I think it is a thrilling debut. And people might already know her work. She's one of the more famous music video directors we have working right now. She did Beyoncé's Formation, that really landmark music video that was touching on things like, you know, Daughters of the Dust, beautiful artwork. It was also about police brutality. You might remember that like several police officers' unions protested it because they thought it was a film that, you know, was too pro
demonized police.
Demonized police. And you see her in this film, Queen and Slim, kind of recycling or kind of honoring a lot of the images from that movie. You know, there's a scene both in the video and here where you have a young black child facing down a whole wall of police officers, you know, and you see that she just has these themes she really loves, that she's this really politically active, engaging director. And what impressed me here is that she can also do romance and like heart and comedy. And you fall in love with this couple as the film goes on.
Are they a fairly new couple or have they been together?
He was about to drop her off and never speak to her again. Yeah. And
so it was a first date.
It was a first date going badly. And you do see that relationship develop and how they end up in those outfits and end up in that purple Bonneville when they go to New Orleans to meet her uncle, who's played by the wonderful Bokeem Woodbine. And he's a pimp. With PTSD from the Afghanistan war. It is all of that's just funny and interesting. Yeah. A lot of commentary about men and women and you know, black families and all of that culture. Every place they go, everybody knows, hey, is this you? You know, and the community comes around them to protect them. I like all of that. But, you know, you shouldn't have run.
The film is Queen and Slim. It's in wide release. It's rated R. And The Frame's John Horn spoke with the director, Melina Matsoukas, as well as the screenwriter, Lena Thwaite. That interview you can hear by linking on our Film Week page at kpecc.org. The Two Popes, directed by Fernando Morales, stars Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Pryce, tells the story of a socially conservative Pope Benedict and the liberal future Pope Francis as they forge a new path for the Catholic Church.
Confidential church documents were allegedly leaked to the press,
alleging corruption
and misconduct among the clergy.
I've struggled to do what must be done, but I've lost.
Popes can't resign. If you do this, you will damage the papacy forever.
I can no longer sit on the chair of St. Peter.
You're mistaken. You are...
Silence! I cannot play this role anymore.
Anthony McCartan wrote the screenplay for The Two Popes. Amy, what do you think?
Yeah, this is a film I enjoyed a lot that's based on two real-life Pope elections that we all remember. The election of Benedict and then the election of Francis shortly after. And in between them, something happened that had not happened in the Catholic Church for 700 years, which is a Pope, Benedict, willingly resigned. The last time that it happened was, I think, 1294, which shows you what a giant shock it was to the system. And so this is a film made by Fernando Moraes. People know him from City of God. He's a really socially conscious filmmaker. He's also a Catholic. And it's a story based on a play, really, that's about these two men coming together who have dramatically different views of what the Catholic Church is and should be, about what the future of the Catholic Church should be. People know that Pope Benedict was more of a traditionalist. He wanted to kind of hold the line against what he saw as like the liberal encroachment of people who were watering down what Catholicism is. Pope Francis, being the first pope from South America, being a person who's, you know, very socially conscious, kind of like a Jimmy Carter sort of figure, he feels now, even today, that we need to be open to things like allowing priests in the rural Amazon to get married. You know, where does the Catholic Church go from here? How does it stay relevant? And so the centerpiece is just this series of conversations, some argumentative, between these two popes about like where the church needs to be going. You know, I'm half Catholic. My mother is a Catholic, so I grew up in the church. And I really do admire watching these people go at it, like talking about their ideas and their visions. And also this movie has, you know, some fun stuff. You watch popes drinking Fanta. You watch them arguing over soccer. You know, there's a humanness to this film that I also really, I really liked. I just kind of sank into this film. I was into it.
So it's historical fiction, right? Because there's we don't have memoirs of the two men documenting any conversations.
Well, they unequivocally did not have this conversation in 2012. The first time they met is after Pope Benedict had resigned and Francis had already become Pope. That's the first time they met. So this didn't happen. A good chunk of this movie is a biography of Pope Francis. We go back to his childhood, his young life, his life as a young man. We see him as a young cardinal in Argentina doing the Troubles of the early 2000s, of the early 1970s, and we discuss some of the sort of political ramifications of some of the things that he was doing then. He's been criticized for some of the things that he did then. He took the side of the government then. That stuff is interesting because that stuff happened. It's documented. Now, these conversations that these two popes are having, this is written by Anthony McCartan, who wrote Darkest Hour. Churchill doing all those grand speeches.
Yeah.
It's a good thing because he really understands this material and he gives them these very individual and specific voices and ideas, their thoughts, how we've gleaned that these people think about religion over the period. But it's all made up. All of this is confabulation. We should keep that in mind.
Yeah, but there's a grand tradition of that. I've seen so many movies about like the weekend Marilyn Monroe spent with Einstein.
Oh, there's one.
You know,
there's one.
In the tradition of that, I think that the ideas they're talking about are very true. Well, I guess.
I don't want to come away from this thinking that I know something about what Cardinal Ratzinger actually thought about these things or the other way around, because it's just not true. That's not what we're going to. There was one about Malcolm X, Malcolm and Martin, fictional meeting between Malcolm X and Martin. Love that movie. But again, all made up. So interesting. The biography is interesting. We don't get as much of a biography of Pope Benedict as we do Franciscus. And they look Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Price.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. They look exactly like them. It's really just a wonderful thing that they do there.
It is really funny to see Anthony Hopkins as Benedict. You know, that character, this film does not start out as a very pro-Benedict. You see him as sort of a political campaigner negotiating to get himself elected as Pope, you know, being really interested in like the vestments and the ceremonies and the necklaces. But this movie did successfully find a bit of a heart in Pope Benedict that I was glad to see. You know, and Anthony Hopkins is just terrifically fun in it.
I would have thought, given Morales as director, it would probably be, you know, highly sympathetic to Francis and
absolutely.
and make Benedict look like a very narrow-minded person.
It definitely starts off like that for sure. And as Francis learns to find what he can really love and value and respect in Benedict, the movie lets us do that too. You really watch a person. It reminded me of the Mr. Rogers movie that just came out. You know, this meeting of like a big-hearted person and somebody more cynical about what life is. And you just watch the kind-hearted person chip away and chip away and learn to love this person. And then you do too as the audience conduit.
All right. The movie is The Two Popes. It's directed by Fernando Morales, written by Anthony McCartan, and it's going to be streaming on Netflix just prior to Christmas. You can see it now, though, on the Landmarks big screen in West L.A. at the Vista in Los Feliz. The Two Popes, rated PG-13. We have a new version of Les Miserables. It's not a musical, and it's French. What'd you think, Tim?
Well, it's not a version of Les Miserables. They're using the title here as a reference to the Victor Hugo.
Kind of like Birth of a Nation.
Kind of like Birth of a Nation.
Oh, the newer film with the title.
Exactly.
Yes.
So this film is set in the district where Victor Hugo actually wrote Les Miserables. During that period, 150 years ago, in the middle of all that strife. It also references the 2005 Paris suburb riots. Which is when this is also set. So we have this team of tactical officers, three of them. A new guy just arrived on the team. And they roll off into these sort of mostly black and Muslim, extremely poor communities, and they try to keep the peace between all of these different people. Ostensibly, there's a story about this little lion that gets stolen by this little boy. And these gypsies are looking for this lion cub, a little tiny lion cub. He's just walking around with it. And they have to find this lion cub or there's going to be this riot that goes down. A little boy gets hurt terribly bad by one of the police officers. And there's a videotape of this, and they have to get this videotape back. And so we have this sort of thrillery story that's going on as we follow these cops, particularly one cop who is just a brutal police officer in the way that he treats all of these poor Muslim people. And we watch this story and we start to understand that what we're watching is sort of this reflection of the whole of Parisian society and how it's being torn apart by all of these tribal factors and how it is exactly the same as it was 150 years ago when Victor Hugo was writing Les Miserables, right in that exact same community that where all of these things are happening now. It's quite fascinating. I really like this movie a lot.
Yeah, exactly. You have the community leaders who want to try to figure out how to keep the peace. You have the community leaders who are ready to start a war over things. You have this film that, you know, the cop subplot in here feels a lot like you're just watching The French Training Day. But I'm at peace with that. And there's a really interesting backstory to this film. You know, the director here, Lajli, He has this really iconic photograph that was taken of him by the photographer J.R., who people might remember from the Agnes Varda film Faces Places. He was the man in that. In 2004, the year before the suburban riots, he was in Paris, and he was going to the suburbs and taking pictures of the young kids and artists and filmmakers in these communities. And he took a photo of this director in 2004 holding a camera like a gun. And this film feels like this extension of that, this artist using art as his weapon to try to talk about the politics of his neighborhood. So I really admire it for all of those reasons a lot. I mean, it feels also kind of a crowd-pleasing, easy-to-like movie. You know, this movie won, I think, the jury prize at Cannes this year. So you see, there are a lot of films I feel like have been in this terrain coming out of Europe, you know, like a lot of them from Scandinavia, films about what are the cops doing in these neighborhoods to try to keep the peace or try to make things worse. And so I appreciate this film as sort of adding to that giant conversation. You know, I think this film will feel really familiar, but also approachable.
Yeah, as much of it is a procedural. But when you understand the politics, when you get into the politics of it, it becomes a very interesting movie.
It's Les Miserables, a brand new film from France. It's directed by Lodge Lee, who also co-wrote the screenplay. It's rated R. You can see it at the Arena Cine Lounge in Hollywood. It will be on Amazon sometime next year. It's an Amazon Studios distributed film, but great chance to see it. Again, Arena Cine Lounge in Hollywood, rated R. Girls on the Run, a Belgium drama, which is written by Mitja Wald. Virginie Gourmel is the director. Amy.
Yeah, I did not love, love, love this film, but I liked its energy. I would say that this is sort of a Girl Interrupted that also takes place in Europe. What you have here is a young girl is brought in, dragging and screaming, into this mental institution, starts fights with her two roommates immediately on site, and then impulsively, the three of them run away together when they get a distraction from the guards. And they're all on this mission to kind of like go to Luxembourg. And it's just sort of this road trip movie of all of them bickering, not really getting along. There's a harshness to it and a brutality in the friendship that I liked a lot. I don't know. What did you think, Tim?
Oh, I did like this movie quite a lot. It's interesting. So the lead girl is a cutter and has attempted to commit suicide a couple of times. What they're ostensibly doing is going to find her father. She wants to go find her father because her father's going to get her out of that psychiatric unit. The middle girl is grotesquely obese and just won't stop eating and has all kinds of issues. And then the other girl, she's a kleptomaniac. So you have a lot of fun with all of that stuff going on in this wacky little movie.
Girls on the Run from Belgium, the film, it's unrated at Lemley's Glendale Theater. We have many more films to talk about on Film Week on 89.3. And a reminder that our Film Week 18th Annual Academy Awards preview will be Sunday, February 2nd, Theater at Ace Hotel, 11 in the morning. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. This week, because of the four-day Thanksgiving holiday weekend, it's a Wednesday and Saturday airing of Film Week. So good to have you with us and give you a chance to see some of these terrific films. Our critics this week are Amy Nicholson and Tim Cogshell. And Tim's going to start us on My Friend, the Polish Girl. Tim?
Wow, this is a really heady little film that seeped into me, this strange little movie. So, ostensibly a documentary, but it's not. It's a fictional film, but ostensibly a documentary. We hear this woman voiceover talking about how she's living in London and she wants to make a film. She decides she's going to find a character, someone. She interviews people. Eventually, she picks this Polish girl about whom she's going to make a movie because the Polish girl tells her something in the interview that she finds intriguing. Not long after that, she finds out that the thing that the Polish girl told her was a lie. This is intriguing, too. She continues to follow her. To document her life. She's an actress and an immigrant. She has a boyfriend. All kinds of things happen. I'm watching this movie, this documentary, and I have to keep reminding myself, wait a minute, no, this is not a documentary. This is a movie. That's not. By the time you get to the end of it, though, you're completely swept up into it. and you're thinking of these people as the individuals who they're supposed to be in the documentary. And that's the way you're thinking about them and listening to them as the director of the documentary sort of insinuates herself into this. But then you have to remember, but she's not the director of the documentary. She's an actress acting in this movie. There's someone else directing this movie. It works, and it got me, and I fell for it, even though I knew it was all fiction.
My friend, the Polish girl, Amy.
I loved this idea, and I could not fall for it. I tried to so hard, but the woman playing the director, who we don't really see her face very much,
mostly
we just
hear her
voice.
Yeah.
Her line readings were just so phony that I could never believe that this was real, and I really wanted to. I really wanted to. It's just nothing in her, the words that came out of her mouth, ever felt believable to me.
Oh, she
which
found,
I thought was such a bummer. Because
she sounded
I think,
like a narcissistic filmmaker to me.
She did, but she sounded like a scripted phony narcissistic filmmaker. I mean, Blair Witch Project, this is not. And no. I wish it was. I wish it was. I think the phony director in that movie is great. Terrific, Heather Donahue. But this wasn't quite there. Although I think the actress who played the Polish actress is really great. It's one of those bold, bold, bold performances from the girl who plays the Polish girl. She just comes in. There's a lot of nudity. There's a lot of rawness to her. She really does have an electric charisma.
And that's Aneta Piotrowska stars in the film. It's written and directed by the wife and husband filmmaking team of Eva Banaszkiewicz and Mateusz Demek. It's unrated. My friend, the Polish girl, is at Lemley's Glendale Theater. The film is set in London, but follows the life of the mock Polish actress. Away is a Latvian animated film that has no dialogue whatsoever. The director and writer of the film is Gints Zilbelodes. Tim?
Who also did the score for the film. 3D animation, although extremely minimalist. There's a lot of depth of field and things, but almost no detail in any of the characters. The characters include this young man, seems like a teenager. The film opens, we see him in a hanging from a parachute in a tree. This is large, dark, sort of blob-like, looming figure, gigantic, that's approaching him. It seems to be after him all the time. He gets out of the tree, he's on this island, and he's running away from this figure. Every now and again, this looming figure. I decided that the figure who's looming over him is conscious or fear, or perhaps it is self-doubt. I'm not exactly sure what that is, but I'm not sure that we're supposed to be sure. He has one little friend, this little bird, and he has a motorcycle. And he's riding across this island, running from this looming figure into all of these absolutely beautiful vignettes of all the animation is just absolutely striking. That thing when he's on the glass pond and you see all the reflections and everything's a double in, it's just beautiful. The score is just, and he did the score, and there are a number of little themes throughout the film. They're just really, really deeply moving and breathtaking, and frankly, I think they take the place of the dialogue. You don't need the dialogue to follow what is going on in this film.
We're talking about the animated film Away, Latvian film. What'd you think, Amy?
Yeah, I mean, to me, this felt like a film for very, very, very young children as a gateway to teaching them about things like war and trauma and how to find a community when you've sort of been isolated. Like, that's how I interpreted this very silent movie, as like a person escaping from what he thought was his fate of dying in war. Because you see him in this parachute at the beginning, he's landed in a tree. He looks like a soldier. He's dressed like a soldier. Mm-hmm. You see some figures that sort of seem like soldiers very often in the distance. And so it felt like kind of talking about what happens to a person when they experience something traumatic like that. I will play the part of Charles Solomon and say I did not like the animation style at all.
You didn't like the whole minimalist 3D thing?
I thought it looked too much like a screensaver for me.
Wow.
But I did enjoy that this film does kind of seem to hit these deep notes about what is a community, what do we owe each other in terms of generosity, in terms of empathy, in terms of giving, and all of his relationships he has with all of the animals all over the film.
I mean, the turtles.
The turtles. There's this whole series with like 40 black cats. You know, I have a black cat in my life who means a lot to me. So to see this animation sequence with 40 very uniform marching black cats.
Charles would have liked that.
I enjoy that. Charles would have liked that. If only Charles were here.
The movie is Away. And like so many of the films, we just talked about the past two of them at Lemley's Glendale Theater. Away is unrated. Recorder, the Marion Stokes Project, a documentary that's at the New Art Theater. Matt Wolff, the director, Amy?
Yeah, this is a really fascinating documentary about a woman named Marion Stokes. She was wealthy. She was on her second husband. She was very intelligent. She was very, very politically engaged. You know, she had gone through the Socialist Party and then the Communist Party. She had considered moving to Cuba in the 50s and 60s. Instead, she winds up in this giant mansion in Philadelphia, married to a man who then helps her buy a series of mansions, all of which she fills up with videotapes and newspapers, primarily videotapes, because what she starts doing is during the Iran hostage affair in 1979, she just starts recording everything that's on all the news channels about it, and then just keeps recording all day, every day, 6 to 8 VCRs going at all times, recording the last 4 decades of American history, and just categorizing it, well, clumsily, on these tapes that seem to freak out all of her extended relatives because her house looks like a hoarder's house, of all these videotapes.
No, it's an archive.
Actually, it is now. Look, that this was hoarding. And there was somebody should have diagnosed her situation 45 years ago. But the result of it is this extraordinary archive that exists now. Now, Marion Stokes, I knew who she was. In the Midwest, they used to do this public affairs programming stuff. The sort of television that you go do at cable stations.
Yeah.
Anybody could go do
public
it.
Access.
Public
stuff.
Access television. And Marion used to pop up on those Sunday morning shows, you know, those public affairs shows with Stokely Carmichael and all the Black Panthers and all that kind of stuff. And she was an activist and a socialist and very well-spoken, this very sort of slender Black woman. And her second husband, John Stokes, was this billionaire. And they would appear on these shows together every now and again, and they just started this relationship. And when he was middle-aged, his children had graduated from college, he divorced his wife and he married Marion. So Marion became this sort of like millionaire. One of the things that she did is she was very technically savvy, Marion. And when Apple came out, she knew that that was something special. She knew Steve Jobs was something special. She bought Apple stock at $7 a share, thus doubling.
So she didn't need her husband's money.
Doubled his fortune. Now, she was a hoarder, and had that, and that's just a fact of the matter, what it is. But she taped all of these things, had a small staff working 24 hours a day, changing tapes. She would get very upset if a tape ran out. You let the tape run out. Sometimes she would sit there changing channels, like she'd be watching something and recording it. It would get uninteresting. She'd change channels to something else. So it's just a haphazard mess.
And the film kind of gets into these definitions, like what is the difference between calling somebody a hoarder or a collector? Like, and what does that really come down to? A hoarder is just something who collects things you don't want.
Yeah.
But we actually kind of want these. And one thing the documentary really does that I love is that it just stops to like show you different parts of what she recorded on the news, to show you Magic Johnson announcing that he has HIV, for example, to show you in one of the centerpiece things, the screen just divides into quadrants and you watch 4 channels slowly realize that 9/11 has happened, starting with CNN, which sees it first, and the 2 hours it takes for it to be on all four channels. Mm. It's really powerful when you watch this documentary and everything she recorded.
Yeah.
Recorder, the Marion Stokes Project documentary from Matt Wolff, the director. It's at the New Art Theater. Is Stokes still living?
No, she died a couple of years ago at age 82. She was born in 1927.
Yeah, it feels like this documentary is almost her son's way of keeping her project alive or honoring what she accomplished.
The Recorder, the Marion Stokes Project is unrated. The film After Parkland is a documentary directed by Jake Lefferman and Emily Taguchi. Amy?
Yeah, this is literally what it is. It's a film about a few of the kids who survived Parkland. You have David Hogg in here. And then you have the most primarily the people who really loved Joaquin Oliver, who was like the basketball star, Guac, who people talked about. And you have these people kind of wrestling with how they feel about it and just sort of kind of a newsy thing. You know, a lot of stories have come out of Parkland, little news pieces like this person took this person to prom. This person's parent is doing this. These people made this memorial. And this is a doc that just sort of chronicles everything and puts it out there sort of straightforward. It's almost so straightforward that to me this documentary maybe feels like Recorder itself. Yeah. Like it's just more valuable as a record of what happened than it is as a film, because this film, I think, wants to be respectful of everybody's viewpoints. And so it winds up feeling like it wants to say something more than it is. You know, you have these two parents in here. You have the parent, the father of Joaquin Oliver, who really channels his pain into creating art, into coaching basketball. And then you have the parent of Meadow, and I'm blanking on her last name, I apologize, but that father has been he kind of went to the root of wanting more security, wanting more guns everywhere. Like he really went in kind of like the, if we had more guns, this wouldn't have happened route. And so you have these two parents kind of telling the camera what they think, and the film just sort of watches them tell us what they think and doesn't really take a side or put anything forward.
Doesn't engage with, ideas put forward.
It's just there, which is why I think I really felt for Victoria Gonzalez. She was the young girl who was Joaquin Oliver's girlfriend. And like her just story of like the day she feels good, the day she feels bad, how she feels in the community, her grief process is really beautiful. And I think it's lovely that she took time to be in this film.
And that student that you were mentioning, Meadow Pollack,
thank you.
Is the name of the student. After Parkland is the documentary. It's unrated. You can see it at Lemley's Monica Film Center. A special one-day-only event on December 4th, one night, is Brana Theater Live, The Winter's Tale. Tim, this is a filmed theatrical performance?
Film theatrical performance. Brana in the play, Dame Judi Dench in the play. Winter's Tale, of course, the tale of another jealous king sends the baby away from the wife who he thinks was having an affair. It's done very, very beautiful. Again, very minimalist, mostly from the proscenium. So we're kind of sitting there like the audience, but they also use other cameras for close-ups and cutaways. It's sort of set in the Victorian sort of area. It's kind of a multimedia thing too. They use projections and all that kind of stuff. You can see them changing the stages in the shadows as the lights go down. It's big, straightforward Kenneth Branagh Shakespeare. It's loud and bombastic. The Dame is fantastic. I really like it a lot.
The Dame, Judi Dench.
Yes.
And the cast also includes Kenneth Branagh himself, Tom Bateman, Miranda Raisin, Rob Ashford, the director, and the writer, of course, Mr. Shakespeare himself. Mm-hmm. Branagh Theater Live, The Winter's Tale is unrated. You can see it at several of the Lemley's theaters around the greater Los Angeles area. Again, one night only, December 4th. I don't know about the two of you, but I love these special one-night screenings, whether it's Fathom Events doing a classic film or live theatrical performances, because I think so many of these things, there isn't an opportunity for people to communally see them on a big screen.
Yeah, particularly these sort of live theatrical sort of, I don't see this otherwise.
No, I love it so much when they come out of London. There's so many productions we would never get to see if they were not broadcast in the theaters. And I love that crowd. Like, you go, sometimes these are the theaters where you can have a glass of wine and everybody's communicating in theater together. It's beautiful.
And you know they already dig the same stuff you do, because that's what's brought you together.
We are a theater of weirdos and we love it.
Again, Branagh Theater Live, The Winter's Tale. And finally, a 30th anniversary screening, one night only, December 3rd, at several of the Lemleys, of When Harry Met Sally. Tim, this is a film that, you know, there's certain iconic clips of this that people still love.
And dearly love this film. My wife and I, first thing, I was going to put this in. I hesitated putting it in, Larry. I was thinking to myself, I wonder if this film is still okay today. I wonder if some of its themes might not be appropriate. Billy Crystal's idea in this movie that men and women cannot be friends, there will always be a sexual sort of dynamic, that's a thin one there that I'm not sure is exactly appropriate for this day. The idea,
Meg Ryan tells him he's wrong in the first scene.
But they still end up together and all married and everything. His thesis turns out to be actually true. So I don't know, but I do love this movie with all my heart.
Some great lines in the film. And the chemistry between the two stars, terrific as well.
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of my favorite films. You know, I do a podcast on Spilled, where we're going through the AFI Top 100, and this film is not on it. And that breaks my heart. This is, I think, one of the best films that's come out of my lifetime.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm so glad it's in theaters again. I mean, it's just amazing. It's a good community movie. It's a good hanging out movie. It is just, I think it, to me, it's perfect. Yeah. I would propose to this movie.
Well, and Nora Ephron, some of the lines she has in this are just gems, absolute gems.
Absolutely.
Rob Reiner directs, of course, When Harry Met Sally, 30th anniversary screening at several of the Lemley theaters, December 3rd, one night only. The film is rated R, probably because of the deli orgasm scene.
I'll have what she's having.
Right. All right. We have much more to talk about on Film Week with our critics right here on 89.3 KPCC. Be back in just over a minute. Not only is the year coming to a close in just over a month, but the decade closing too. And that gives us a chance to talk with our critics today about what they're looking forward to in the remaining month of 2019, and to also look back on what they think are the most memorable, the most significant films of this past decade. In case you just joined us, our critics Amy Nicholson and Tim Cogshell. Let's talk first about what you're looking forward to in the remaining month of the year. You know, typically December, the big awards push of films, a little more dispersed on the schedule than they used to be. But Amy, are you looking forward to a particular film coming up?
Well, you know, Tim and I have already seen most of the big things because we're in LAFCA and we vote soon, which means the main film that we're not going to get to see in time that I cannot wait to see is Cats.
Mm. Cats?
Oh my gosh.
I cannot wait to see Cats. I don't know what to make of Cats. I think Cats might blow my mind in maybe a good way, maybe a bad way. I will probably see Cats 5 times. It just sounds like the kind of movie that I will never know if I love or hate it, but I will just be there.
This is the Andrew Lloyd Webber Cats
yes,
to the big screen.
Yeah, we're played by, you know, Taylor Swift, Idris Elba, a lot of amazing people who are just dressed like cats, but also very,
with
very small.
Odd sort of CGI thing going on.
The proportions make no sense. Everybody's human-ish, but very tiny with giant chairs. I don't even know what's going to happen. Every time I watch a trailer, I just get so happy.
Every time I watch that trailer, I get a little creeped out.
Yeah, it's one of the few live stage productions I actually left at intermission.
I couldn't take it.
No, I'm not.
Oh my goodness!
What are you looking forward to, Tim?
Kristen Stewart. I'm a big ridiculous fan of hers. She has a Gene Seberg biopic coming out, where she plays Gene Seberg. And I can't wait to see that, mostly on the strength of Miss Stewart, because I think that she has just become one of the most extraordinary actors that there is out there. Also, Adam, I think Amy already saw it, but I haven't seen it. Adam Sandler has a film coming out called Uncut Gems.
Uncut Gems. Oh, I'm so excited for you to see it.
You've seen it, so perhaps you want to tell the people about it a little bit. But I'm excited to see that. Every now and again, Adam, after you, bad movie, great movie. And I think that this might be one of those.
Oh,
who's absolutely. Who's the director of the film?
It's the Safdie brothers, who did Good Time a few years ago. That really kind of chaotic, super fun movie. And this is Adam Sandler as a jewelry dealer who lies to everybody in his life, including the basketball player Kevin Garnett, who is in this movie, who is excellent. And it's just a very condensed window into a few days in this jewelry man's life as he lies to everyone in his family and everyone he ever meets and just makes his life get worse and worse. It is the tensest movie I have ever seen. I saw it in Toronto.
Not a comedy.
It's really funny, but also you're miserable. I loved it. I was drinking this giant iced coffee and I was shaking by the time the movie ended. That's what this movie does to you. It is a terrifically miserable, wonderful experience.
All right. So, Tim, you're yet to see that.
I'll be definitely looking forward to it.
All right. Well, let's talk about the most influential films of the past decade, ones that really stayed with you, that you spent a lot of time on. Tim, you want to start with the ones that are most memorable?
Well, it's interesting because I went all the way back to 2010. There's a wonderful French film called Andancies, which was just a lovely, lovely film. But I got to tell you, Terrence Malick's Tree of Life. This is a film that I still think about. This is a film that I see a lot of other films sort of mocking a little bit or biting a little bit in terms of style, the sort of flow. Tree of Life was just a deeply moving, meaningful film for me. A lot of Terrence Malick's films, you know, but this is one that hit me real hard and I loved it. Beasts of the Southern Wild. That's just another one. This beautifully poetic little movie.
Like no other film you are ever going to see.
Yeah.
It's just stunningly original.
Yeah, yeah. With that little girl and that family and these sort of ideas that are in this beautiful little movie, it's another movie that I think about it. On the large side, I have to say, Mr. Spielberg's Lincoln, this is a film that I can still put in and watch.
I love that movie.
He understood something about that period and that war. The way he opens that film with that black soldier pleading for the right to fight on his own behalf. Only Mr. Spielberg knew that this is the way you have to open this movie.
Yeah, I love that film. For Amy, for you. Your favorites of the decade.
Yeah, for me, what I think is really exciting is just that we have a lot of people who came out in this decade with their first film, second film, third film that I feel like we're going to see for a long time. That this is a decade to me of brand new innovation. I mean, probably my favorite thing that I think is really going to change Hollywood in the next 10 years is that little clique of filmmakers who are coming out of San Francisco and Oakland. You know, like Boots Riley, who did Sorry to Bother You, the team who did Blindspotting, the film that came out this year, Last Black Man in San Francisco. These are all first-time filmmakers, incredible artists. They really have a point of view. They're very political. They're very funny. They're bending genres. They're making things that are wild and wacky and completely unique. And they seem to tangentially all know each other. And I'm fascinated in this idea of this generation rising up. And like, I think they really have a tendency, or they have the opening to change film, honestly. Like, I think they might be one of the people who wind up defining who we are as film, as film in this era.
Mm.
All right. Some of the other filmmakers who really have come up in this era. I mean, we've seen Ava DuVernay, who's become a hyphenate, you know, producer, director, television mogul, you know. So she's someone who in this decade has become highly influential. Who are some of the others that you think
Watch? I mean, the person who I think taps the most directly into my psyche that we've had this decade is Yorgos Lanthimos.
No, The Lobster.
Yeah, The Lobster, The Favorite. I mean, Yorgos Lanthimos' films are so cold and so ironic, and yet they cut so much into the worst parts of being a human being that I feel naked every time I watch a Yorgos Lanthimos film, and he fascinates me. Like, he feels like he makes films that are going to reverberate for a very long time. I love being alive when there's new Yorgos Lanthimos films coming out.
Yeah. Kenneth Lonergan, you can lean on, going all the way back, right up to Manchester by the Sea. A deeply powerful dramatic filmmaker. Barry Jenkins, just in recent years, both Moonlight and Bill Street. Again,
again, coming out of San Francisco, what's in the water up there?
Yeah, and these are sort of like new voices, too. But I mean, Lonergan's been around for a while, but there's something about his films. I feel the same way that you said. His films are always deeply penetrating and very, very, very earnest and true.
Yeah, and it's interesting with the style that we see. Jenkins, a great example, where he's so unafraid of putting so much style on the screen. I mean, to the point where some critics, with his last film, the title of which escaped me, there was some criticism that was, you know, more stylish than
if Bill Street could talk. And it's an extremely stylish film. The color schemes and they're all fine, but I like that. And I appreciate it deeply. Plus, it's just his voice. Look, Barry Jenkins is a African-American filmmaker, but Barry Jenkins doesn't make urban films. He makes mainstream dramatic films, which I think is a very specific sort of thing for an African-American filmmaker to be allowed to do.
Yeah. And well, how much of this is that with the rise of independent film, the ability to do movies less expensively is allowing directors, even early in their career, to have more control?
I think that's a huge part of it. I mean, Barry Jenkins' first film, Medicine for Melancholy, a really lovely film that starred the comedian Wyatt Cenac, I believe he funded that by selling a car and also his job at Banana Republic. I mean, that is a film he made for no money, and we're able to do that now because now we don't have a creation problem. Now we have a publicity and distribution problem. There's just too many good, tiny, independent films.
But for someone, a first-time filmmaker, to make a film, put it on YouTube, or you know, to make it with an iPhone or whatever, people do it.
Oh, yeah. The Florida Project Tangerines. Literally, the Tangerines made with this iPhone.
Exactly.
An absolutely sort of striking verite sort of film.
I think that film will definitely be one that we also really look to as something that defines this decade. You know, Sean Baker's work in Tangerine.
Yeah.
And also Florida Project.
Oh, it's so good. And using, you know, local actors and the motel is such a star of that production. Just wonderful.
Exactly. And you know what's interesting about all the people we're mentioning is these are films made by filmmakers with a conscience, but not a conscience in the way of like the 90s or even the first decade of this millennium, where it's sort of tedious and telling you what you already think. These are just interesting people who also seem to have a heart and a soul.
Yeah, I mean, the Florida Project, I didn't take any preaching in that.
It's just
showing us a world.
Yeah.
And in a, you know, realistic depiction of people's everyday struggle, and people aren't sort of prettied up or made nicer than they would really be in the real world, and yet you can still have an identification with sometimes very difficult characters. We'll continue our conversation with our critics about the films they think are most influential, the directors who've made the biggest impression on them over the course of this decade. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Our critics, Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com, and Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian and host of the podcast Unspooled and the podcast miniseries Zoom. Back in a minute. Wonderful to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a terrific Thanksgiving weekend. Just easing into it. If you're listening live Wednesday or if you're listening Saturday, hope you had a wonderful gathering with family and friends and are just enjoying the holiday. We're continuing with our critics, Amy and Tim, focused on the most influential or memorable films. We're making it kind of loose how to define it. I don't have a very refined idea here, but just the movies that they maybe go back to and think about over the course of the past decade. If you have some you'd like to share with us, you can do it by visiting our Film Week page, kpcc.org. You can also call us at 866-893-5722. That if you're listening to our live Wednesday Film Week airing. Taylor Sheridan with Sicario and Hell or High Water.
Oh, yeah.
I just love that. That's one I could watch almost infinite number of times.
And such a classically produced film. We were talking about style. That movie's not so much about style. It's about character.
Although there's some great long shots of the desert.
Real classic stuff. But that's acting. That's an actor's piece. And it's just a fantastic movie.
I love Ben Foster.
Yeah, Ben Foster, so good in it. We haven't talked about the influence of the superhero comic book films, but to me, perhaps the pinnacle was Logan.
Christopher McQuarrie.
Yeah, just terrific film.
I think that is the best one, because to me that felt like its own independent standalone story, its own look, its own style, its own tone. It didn't have to blend into a universe. And then adjacent to it, it's not quite superhero, but I think Mad Max Fury Road, that's going to wind up still, I think that still has a lot of impact, that and John Wick, in the fact that we are more interested again in practical effects and in actual stunts. And there's a hunger for that. I think we are, like, those films are almost combating the superhero CGI world.
Yeah, and the Mad Max Fury Road, it's had a smile the whole, there's just so much that's funny and just visually just so light in a film that's also relentless at the same time.
Yeah. Charlize is particularly wonderful in that movie. I mean, it's called Mad Max Fury Road,
but it's her film.
It's her film. And I like that it's her film.
Once again, if you have what you think are the most influential, most memorable films of this decade, you can share it if you're listening live Wednesday, 866-893-5722, or our Film Week page, kpecc.org. Also wanted to talk about Black Panther, of course, because that is very influential. And I'll throw Wonder Woman in there because, again, having a woman as the lead character, I thought that was a terrific film. Woman directed it.
They both managed to be fairly pointed about their politics and their themes while still being wildly entertaining. Big, gigantic popcorn entertainment, at the same time making some very specific statements in the context of Black Panther, Killmonger, that character, Michael B. Jordan's character. He was fantastic. I felt he should have been nominated for an Academy Award for that performance myself. But the ideas of this black community speaking to itself, you know, what are you doing for your own black people? That's in that big popcorn movie. And I like that you can do both. And I think that Ryan Coogler proved that you can do both.
Also, we should talk about Winter's Bone.
Who's
done a number of outstanding films over the course of the decade, largely flying under the general audience radar, but real critical favorites.
Yeah,
absolutely. And, a film like that gave us Jennifer Lawrence. I think that's why I know as film critics were supposed to grumble and be like, everything's going downhill. But I'm so thrilled right now with what's happening in movies. And that I do feel like I grew up with a world of just like the last generation's actors who are still our movie stars, who are still hanging on. And now I feel like when I go to the movies, I see all these faces that are really making their career. You know, people from like Margot Robbie, Caitlin Dever, Tessa Thompson, Cynthia Erivo, who I think is one of the most exciting actors to come out recently.
Harriet.
In Harriet, mm-hmm. yeah. And then before that,
the Hotel Bad Times at the Royale.
I really enjoyed that movie. And Kristen Stewart, who I adore. And I thought, you know what? I'll stick up for Charlie's Angels. I'm a few weeks behind on this, but she was great in that movie.
I said so a week ago or 2 weeks ago. I said the exact same thing. And of course, there's Jordan Peele and what he's done to reinvigorate the horror genre by, again, insinuating politics and other ideas into
well,
that.
Well, Get Out to me is an extraordinary film because how it can be both so funny and so chilling at the same time. I mean, striking that tonal tightrope walk, that is an extraordinary artistic accomplishment.
Yeah, yeah. Polanski is the kind of guy who would do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who could have that? You're both just sort of, you know, repulsed and chilled at the same time. You're laughing at what you see taking part.
Exactly. And Larry knows that I love watching the horror beat so much because I think it's really where some of the interesting ideas come out. You know, there's a film coming out in a week or two called Daniel Isn't Real. That's one of my favorite horror films of the year. It's like there's just really good stuff.
Charlie in Westminster says, I, Tanya, funniest thing I've seen in 40 years since Freebie and the Bean back in the 1970s.
Yes.
Yeah, I, Tanya was, and again, it's so hard to do those kinds of films that tonally are playing from both ends of the themes. Again, you on our Film Week page, you can share some of your favorites with us over the course of the past decade, or you can call. We have just a couple minutes left. If you're listening live Wednesday, 866-893-5722. Pedro Almodovar, this past decade, has he kept his chops up as the director?
Right up to the present moment. He has a film out right now. The Skin I Live In is the one that I put on my little list.
Yeah.
There. That was just, particularly when we consider that it was just prior to the whole sort of Me Too thing that happened. For him to make a movie about that, I guess I won't get the theme of the movie away, but it's transformative. I'll say it like that. It was really just sort of an amazing, sort of prescient sort of thing to do.
All right. You also have a Woody Allen film, Blue Jasmine,
yes.
on your list.
It might not be popular, but Blue Jasmine, Cate Blanchett, just absolutely exquisite performance in that movie. Woody had a little renaissance there for a minute,
Midnight in Paris
and all that kind of stuff. And I have to throw down for my homie Spike, Black Klansman last year. A lot of people did not see Chirac. Chirac is a wonderful movie. Nick Cannon, extraordinary in that film. And again, social commentary.
Chirac is terrific.
Retasking Lissa Strata as a...
And Black Klansman, again, combining the humor with social commentary and the great Terrence Blanchard score that's a part of him.
Yeah.
It's terrific.
Yeah.
All right. We're talking about the films that were most influential for our critics over the course of this past decade. You also have The Martian on your list, Tim.
I do. For what it does, for love of science and space and its attempt to bring a large audience to these notions and ideas. I love that the guy in that movie is going to science his way off of Mars, and he does.
Can we science our way to a better planet now here?
Well, you've also got Hidden Figures, which is a math technology film.
Yes, and a revelation even to me. I did not know about I did not know about these women and what they had done. And this film, while still being grandly entertaining, telling us the story about these women.
All right, very good. Quickly, Amy, back to horror films. Do you have a couple of ones that, Hereditary or any others that just really...
Oh, I mean, I love Ari Aster. I think everything he's doing with Midsommar is really fantastic. I think we're just seeing that genre really explode. I feel like there are true artists coming out of there, with like interesting ideas about music, interesting ideas about gender. I was not the biggest fan of It Follows, but even just the fact that we live in a world where It Follows exists, or The Witch. I love these movies.
All right. Hey, thank you both so much. Appreciate it. As we heard from Amy Nicholson, Tim Cockshell laying out for us the most influential and memorable films over the course of the past decade. As always, we appreciate your joining us for Film Week, typically Fridays at 11 and Saturdays at noon, this week with a special Thanksgiving weekend early Wednesday live broadcast of the program. Back with you next Friday and Saturday on KPCC.